So this is the 18th of June, 2014. I'm Rick Hansen. And I wanted to talk about one of the absolutely central, arguably the central teaching in Buddhism, which is the recognition of impermanence. And to do that, I want to go back to last week. I think a lot of you were here last week. I was exploring the intersection of compassion and equanimity. In other words, it's relatively straightforward to be loving toward other people, especially, you know, in relationships, obviously, that are important to us. It's also relatively straightforward, maybe not so easy, but relatively straightforward, to have a kind of detachment or an evenness or a balance and equanimity with regard to those relationships. But to do both, to be both very loving while remaining undisturbed in one's core, that's not so easy to do. So we explored different aspects of that last week, and I was thinking about taking the teachings related to equanimity, which sometimes is defined as walking evenly over uneven ground. Or to quote a minister in Los Angeles, looking at the world through quiet eyes, seeing the whole of the world, the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows, but seeing all of it with quiet eyes. Or more technically, in terms of our neuropsychology, our experiences continually have what's called in psychology a hedonic tone of being pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. In Buddhist psychology, that's referred to as the feeling tone, but it's the same thing, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And the question is, can we be with the pleasant? Can we be with the unpleasant? Can we be with the neutral without being disturbed by the hedonic tone of our experiences? Right? Some things feel good, we like them. Some things feel bad, we don't like them. Some things feel neutral, we kind of wish they would get better. Right? But do we have to go to war with what's unpleasant? Do we have to be driven about what's pleasant? Do we have to be addictive so that we can't tolerate things that are neutral? Equanimity lets us be with the pleasant, the unpleasant, and the neutral without being disturbed by it. That's another important aspect of equanimity. And then there is the dimension of impermanence. It is said in the Buddha Dharma that the recognition of impermanence, the felt recognition, starting often conceptually, not always, but often conceptually, but coming down into the body increasingly, the felt recognition that things keep changing, also supports equanimity. Because as we recognize that our reactions to things change and outer events themselves change, outer conditions themselves change, as we recognize that, we get less upset about them. That's the kind of setup here. In the Buddha's time, soon after he died, within a century or two after, there was a standard saying that can be found on statues throughout northern India that survived the invasion of various people in the early centuries of the Common Era. You can find statues where there was a basic saying, and anyone who said that was considered to be Buddhist. Like, in other words, that was kind of the essence, you could say. And the basic saying is present in the quotation I gave to you at the beginning of the meditation tonight, and also at around 7 o'clock, which is, anyone who recognizes that which is subject to arising is also subject to passing away, practices the way of the Buddha. In other words, you, I, anyone who recognizes that all that which arises must also inherently, inevitably, pass away, practices the way of the Buddha. Now, first, we get to decide for ourselves if we think it's actually true, that things are impermanent. And we also get to decide whether that matters in any meaningful way. But it is the case that anyone who is interested in exploring and increasingly perhaps adopting, the way of the Buddha, is in some ways fundamentally defined by this recognition of impermanence. It's that central to Buddhist practice, if that matters to a person. Okay? It's a way of really underlining the importance of this engagement with impermanence. Okay. So I'm embarrassed to say that I've never given a Dharma talk on impermanence, notwithstanding the buildup. And you might like the most recent Just One Thing that came out today called Enjoy Now, which is a variation on this theme. So I'm happy to say I've written about impermanence, but I've never given a Dharma talk. So if I'm awkward about this or, you know, kind of zig or zag, I will take refuge in the fact that this event also is impermanent. Okay. I may need a little light at some point, you know, especially as the sun finally goes down, because that's impermanent too, right? So I want to read you a couple of quotes and then talk about them a little bit, read a few more. Great, thanks for that. Talk about them. We can really explore this together, I hope. Okay. So to begin with, this is a very pithy teaching from the great Zen master, Hakuin, who says, "Pointing directly to the heart-mind, see your own nature and become Buddha." Pointing directly to the heart-mind, see your own nature and become Buddha. So we have three parts there, right? The heart-mind, the essence of mind. See its nature. See your own nature. And in the seeing, become Buddha. Like, wow, you could spend a long time playing around with that one. Right? Just every day, kind of look at it, go, whoa. So I want to flag an underlying theme here, which I hope to explore with you, which is the dance of impermanence and true nature. And true nature is not impermanent. So how do these two interact? And you'll see this dance in the quotes that follow. Pointing directly to your own heart-mind, see your own nature and become Buddha. So, this quote says, "The entire world is in flames. The entire world is going up in smoke. The entire world is burning. The entire world is vibrating. But that which does not vibrate or burn, which is experienced by the noble ones, where death has no entry, in that my mind delights." By the way, I think I'm going to send you all, if you're on the email list for this sitting group, I'm just going to send out these quotations. I'll do a little emailing in a couple days, so you don't have to memorize them or stress about it. The person who likes the talk the most, I'll give this handout to you at the end. No, I'm just kidding. Okay. Anyway, so I'll do that. And if you want to be on the email list for this sitting group and you're not already, if you don't get stuff related to the sitting group, there's a sign-up sheet over there. Okay? So I want to go back to this. The entire world is in flames. So usually when the Buddha talks about world or anything, he's talking about our experience, our phenomenology, right? Thoughts, feelings, perceptions, and the rest of it. He presumed the existence of a material world, but past the barest presumption of a material universe, he was only interested in our experience, you know, particularly suffering and its end. All right? So when he just talks about the world, he means the experienced world. Now, you could argue as well that the material world is like a flame. It's continually changing on one time scale or another. But where this material is especially clear is in terms of our own experience. And that's a way for me to introduce a kind of framework for what I hope to explore with you tonight, which is a three-part framework. The first part is, here you are. And I'm thinking of doing a slide of some newborn looking like this. What the heck, right? So we come into this existence, what do we know? We only know our experience. We know pressure, we know sensation, we know sounds, sights, we know our own thoughts, our own internal process. The presumed material world, we never know directly. We live only in a virtual world, right? Our own experience, our own phenomenology. No one can get out of, at least in ordinary consciousness or in ordinary terms, no one can get out of living entirely in a reality, a world that's constructed, and constructed arbitrarily. One way to understand that is if you think of the whole electromagnetic spectrum, we see maybe 1% of the whole spectrum. If you think about the ways in which animals evolve different kinds of nervous systems that can do different things, think about the visual experience of a fly who sees the world through multifaceted eyes, right? So where we start is what we know exists. You know, we know there is hearing. We know there is seeing. We know there is thinking because we're in the middle of all that. So that's the level of phenomenology. Then there's the level of materiality, the presumed material universe, which includes a lot of wild stuff, right? Black holes, quarks, quantum physics, crazy stuff, but it's a material universe in which energy and matter, you know, intertwine with each other. Okay? So far, so obvious, right? Then many people, myself included, and I believe that you will find it as well in the teachings of the Buddha, there is a third level. It's very difficult to talk about because as soon as we talk about it, whoop, we're up here in phenomenology or beliefs inside our phenomenal experiential world about the material universe. But this is a domain that you'll hear referred to, and I've referred to already, as the deathless, or the unconditioned, or I call it unconditionality, or that which does not vibrate or burn. So you see it right there, these three levels. You know, the world is in flames, the world is burning and vibrating, but that which does not vibrate or burn, which is experienced by awakened beings, is where we're working toward, moving toward. Where death has no entry, death meaning the endings of things, the passing away, where impermanence has no entry, in that my mind delights. Since anything that arises must also pass away, the realm in which nothing passes away is also a realm in which nothing new arises. So you see the three levels here? This little framework, you know, experience, material universe, including lots of mysteries that remain about it, and potentially something that's outside of the realm of experience or the realm of materiality. Call it the deathless, the unconditioned. Some people would call it the ground. Some people would call it the divine. That's that possible third level. Most people agree. I think just about everybody agrees that there is experience, right? I think most people also presume that there is a material universe in which our experiences arise and pass away, and in which we can infer a lot about. Okay? Some people are willing to grant the possibility of, or they actually have an intuition of, unconditionality, this transcendental aspect. Okay, so this is the territory we're working in. So to read another quote here, these are from the Dharma in the Pali Canon, the earliest teachings of the Buddha. This one right now is from the Dhammapada. The passage reads, "O house builder, you are seen." The house builder is the ordinary mind, constructing the world in which we live. "O house builder, you are seen. You will not build this house again. For your rafters are broken and your ridge pole shattered. My mind has reached the unconditioned. I have attained the destruction of craving." this is a passage that appears often when the Buddha talks about his own awakening. And you can feel, for me at least, the exultation in this passage. You know, if this was, it'd be like, yeah! It has that feeling to it, right? Oh, House Buddha, I see you. I've seen through the illusion of this mechanical, ongoing construction process. The whole business is shattered. Why is it shattered? I've reached the unconditioned. I reached the unconditioned through the destruction of craving, or tantamount to, or equal to, resting in unconditionality is the end of craving. So you see that this is hardcore Dharma. This is kind of like bullseye Dharma, bullseye Buddha, no offense meant. It's like right at the core, right? We have things changing, suffering, unconditionality, and the end of craving in one short passage. Okay? Including this joy, this freedom at, you know, as the Buddha says in other passages, recognizing the gratification, the danger, and the escape of ordinary lived existence. Okay. So then, here's another quote, and then I want to see what you think about this so far. This is from a collection of teachings that are probably among the oldest, which means earliest, written teachings of the Dharma. And there's a simplicity to these early teachings and a lack of fancy philosophy or metaphysics that leads a lot of people, scholars, to think that this is pretty close to the Buddha's core teachings. So he writes here, or says here as best we know, the born, in other words, the conditioned, arising due to causes, the born come to be produced, the made, the conditioned, the transient, joined with decay and death, a nest of disease, perishable, sprung from nutriment and craving's cord, nutriment being essentially desires, that is not fit to take delight in. Don't mess with that stuff, the Buddha is saying. Then, in other words, the danger, the gratification and the danger are in that passage right there. The escape from that, the peaceful, beyond reasoning, everlasting, the not born, the unproduced, the sorrowless state that is void of stain, the cessation of states linked to suffering, the stilling of the conditioned, bliss. Right? So you see conditioned phenomena moving through our experience. Arguably as well, conditioned phenomena in the material world. No basis for true happiness. Full of suffering. Not fit to identify with or take delight in. But escaping from that, disengaging from the conditioned stream, the stilling of the awareness of the conditioned stream, bliss. Any questions so far? Tarane.
Even though that statement would suggest that the Buddha somehow was living in eternal bliss after he reached that point, he lived as a normal human being with pain.
Could you speak up a little just because of the fan?
Oh,
because what you're saying is very important.
Even though it sounds like the Buddha then lived in eternal bliss and happiness, and it was just, you know, everything was fabulous, he still lived as a normal man with a back problem and dysentery and issues with his sangha, and had to walk for miles and miles and miles, you know, teaching and all kinds of issues to deal with. He just lived as a human being like any of us after that happened. That's interesting.
It is. It really is. Yeah, I mean, it's exactly right, and it goes to, there was a lot of unpleasant. No pain control, you know, disease, walking, lots of unpleasant. But the question is it possible to have some kind of intuition of unconditionality or the deathless, the sometimes called the sorrowless, stainless, farther shore? Is it possible to have an intuition of that in nirvana that radically changes our relationship to the stream of consciousness, to the stream of conditioned experiences? And also, is it possible that that radical trans-experiential something or other can then also leave us with access to some sense of unconditionality, even in the midst of conditioned experiences? And that's my way of thinking about what's actually possible. Even as a body, flesh and blood, you know, subject to old age, disease, and death. Okay, so we've kind of set the table here, and then I want to talk about impermanence. And why? So you see the great themes here. You know, conditioned states, no basis for happiness, finding some way to a something or other that transcends ordinary conditioned existence is the ultimate aim, certainly as taught in early Buddhism. Okay? So then the question becomes, how do we do it? Right? And that's where the recognition of impermanence really starts to come in. To quote something else from the Dhammapada, whenever and wherever one encounters the arising and passing away of the mental physical structure, one enjoys bliss and delight, which lead on to the deathless state experienced by the wise. So I'm going to read that again. And I invite you to engage these kind of teachings the way I do, which is to slow it down and to actually relate to them in effect as instructions from Coach Buddha or a prescription from the Buddha as physician. In other words, this is someone who says, look, we've all got this problem of suffering for all kinds of reasons. I've solved this problem, certainly for myself, and I want to tell you about the solution. See what you think. Right? That's the frame here. So these are very specific. And it's psychological. It's not metaphysical. It's not philosophical. So he says, whenever you encounter experientially the arising and passing away of thoughts, feelings, sensations, memories, whenever you encounter that arising and passing away in your own experience, whenever you're grounded in the transience of this present moment, one enjoys bliss and delight. In the moment, you're not yet enlightened, but in the moment, if you're right in the now and you're in touch with things arising and passing away extremely rapidly, that is blissful and delightful, is the Buddha's statement. Why would that be? If ordinary experience, you know, conditioned phenomena, is full of suffering, why would the recognition of the transience of our experiences lead to bliss and delight? It's through what's called disenchantment and ultimately disidentification and dispassion. In other words, we recognize that experiences come and go when we're in this recognition of arising and passing away. But because we see them arising and passing away really fast, so fast that we can't hold on to any of them, we become increasingly disenchanted with our experience. It's okay. It's nice. It's unpleasant. It's pleasant. It comes and goes. We can't hold on to it. And we get more and more disidentified from it. It's just experience. It's just there. And we're right in this amazing nowness of this moment as it disappears beneath our feet. And I think you will find, as I have, that if you just, even for a few seconds, have that felt sense, that experience, that felt recognition. It's mind-blowing. And it frees you from clinging and thus suffering in the moment. And it's kind of ecstatic to see the transience of this moment of experience. And then he goes on to say, and that recognition, as it deepens for you, and you have it more and more frequently, and becomes, it even starts moving into the background of a, as a kind of perspective on lived existence, that leads on to the ultimate, the deathless stage experienced by the wise. So you see the, in other words, the recognition of impermanence doesn't just recognize what's true. Things are impermanent, right? Thoughts last barely a second or two or three, the particular thought, right? Recognizing impermanence is not just living in truth, it's skillful means. It's an extraordinarily powerful tool that's available to us in every moment, right under our nose. But it takes a constant effort to see. As George Orwell put it, to see what is in front of one's nose takes a constant effort. I just have a couple more pieces of advice from our teacher, the Buddha. He says, above, across, or back again, wherever one goes in the world, let one carefully scrutinize the rise and fall of compounded things. Wherever you go, keep coming back to transience, impermanence. This too shall pass. And then the last quote I'll read here, let go of the past, let go of the future. Let go of the present and cross over to the farther shore of existence. With mind wholly liberated, you shall come no more to birth and death. It's a big game, right? But that's, see for yourself, but that's core dharma, fundamental teaching, which gets at Buddha Dharma as much more than, you know, being mindful or being nice to other people, as important as those are. I mean, the problem of suffering is too big to solve with mindfulness and kindness alone. And the opportunity for the deathless, for that stainless, profound, unconditional inner peace, that opportunity is much greater than can be fulfilled through mindfulness or kindness alone. So, why don't I pause right here and see what you think about all this, including as applied to those relationships that really aggravate us. How about first you, then you? Okay, great. Please.
Does he ever say anything about the bliss of nature and a sunset and a sunrise and birds and the bliss of that? Does he ever mention
those are the outer rings of the bullseye. What I mean by that is that, so the question was, does the Buddha talk about very much the, the bliss or happiness, if you will, of nature, sunrise, trees, and stuff like that?
Yes.
And obviously, too, the Buddha stream, I think of it as a teaching stream that's 2,500 years old. You know, it originated at one source, but then it spread quickly. And who knows if the Buddha exactly said these words? Maybe somebody else who's tuning into the Buddha stream, you know, said that. We kind of don't know. We never will, so be it. That said, you know, later on, there is a lot of appreciation for nature, especially in Zen, you know, comes in. Yeah. The Buddha does talk about the happiness visible in this present life, and he does talk about wholesome pleasures, including good company. He really talked about that, community. You know, it's very, very important. But let's be clear as well. He's acknowledging the pleasures. He lived as a prince, in effect, you know, as a young nobleman. He had access to a lot of pleasure. But his purpose as a teacher, as a doctor, is to try to disenchant us with regard to the worldly realm. You know, he's going after enlightenment. And he is, and the core of the people he was teaching were practicing renunciation. You know, and in a sense, he's saying, as he did, wisdom is choosing a greater happiness over a lesser one. So I suspect he would say, sure, hot chocolate tastes good. Petting your cat is wonderful, right? It's beautiful to look outside and see the green of the trees, right? To feel the coolness of the fan. That's wonderful. And I think he would say, I say this with respect, there is also a greater happiness than that. And I think he would say, if you observe closely your relationship to the deliciousness of a cup of hot chocolate, there's a fair amount of subtle and gross, certainly subtle suffering woven into the pleasure of a cup of hot chocolate, including the awareness that it will end soon. Right? So I'm very glad you brought this up, especially relevant for us as householders. You know, what do you want to choose? Do you want to choose a shirt that feels comfortable or a shirt that is scratchy? Comfortable. You know, what would you wish for your child, your friend? A shirt that's comfortable, a shirt that's scratchy? Really good hot chocolate or that thin, crummy stuff they serve in some hotels, you know?
I was talking about
nature. Nature. What would you, right, nature's good. There's a place for that. But you ask yourself, is that ultimate happiness? I don't know about you, but for me, I get most committed to spiritual practice, usually under one of two conditions, either or both. One is if I'm really miserable, spiritual practice looks really good. Or if I've been having a great run, life is sweet, lots of sunsets, lots of trees, lots of tulips, lots of hot chocolate, and this little voice inside starts getting louder and louder, saying essentially, is this it? Right? So see for yourself. Okay, great, yeah.
This is almost more practical question.
Yeah, or comment, not just questions too, yeah.
Intellectual understanding of the impermanence.
Yeah. Yeah.
And intellectually knowing the impermanence, but there's like that ego craving to look for stability and ground, and it can feel threatening to that part of the ego to feel the impermanence. So is there a practical way in for
impermanence in that situation? That's a beautiful, deep question and comment, you know, just to say it again. So what about people or people in general? What's a practical way to really deepen the recognition of impermanence? And especially for people for whom that recognition can be alarming, especially people who've had maybe a trauma history. And it is commonly described that as people progress in their practice, particularly on retreats where they're really concentrated and very absorbed and very close to the granularity of experience, it can become alarming. I've experienced that, where you just feel like, whoa, you know, everything is disappearing so fast. You know, and my version of that is, you're on the 23rd floor, you walk up to the elevator, you push the button, the doors open, you step in, whoop, and there's no floor beneath you. It's like, whoa, your experience is just disappearing. And people can become freaked out about it. For me, it was pretty okay, because I had read about that, I was kind of also there, okay with it. But it's still weird, okay? One is, start by noticing arisings. Right? There's always something new, right? Another sensation, something else foregrounding in attention, something new appearing or emerging. That's really helpful. Another thing is to realize that there are things that are relatively permanent. The going on being of the body is relatively permanent, right? The great child psychiatrist Winnicott talked about the importance for an infant and toddler through ideally secure caregiving to come to a basic trust. Eric Erickson talked about that as well as the first of the 8 stages, I guess, of human development. Basic trust in which there's a going on being, right? So that part of things that are relatively permanent are resources around us in which we have the going on being of the natural world. Trees keep going on producing oxygen that we breathe, you know. People who love us keep on loving us. And there's a going on being there. Very important. It's really important to buttress our insight with love. Feeling loved, feeling loving. Otherwise, insight can become, the Buddha would call it nihilistic. And, or, you know, you can deconstruct anything, you can doubt anything. I've met a number of people who are very good at doubting, and the more they doubt, the more weird they got. You know, the weirder they got, right? And then, at an even deeper level, and I don't want to let you go without pointing this out as well, if it's real for you, you might have, like, flashes between ongoing experience, or just in the midst of experience, relatively available access to a sense of some kind of unconditionality ground out of which conditioned phenomena appear and into which conditioned phenomena disappear in the infinitely thin slice of time that is this instant now. And it is interesting that the Buddha really puts those two together again and again. And these are teachings for regular people, you know. He would start out with ethics and generosity, but fairly quickly, this is straight-up Dharma. And one reason why these lines and sayings are so short and pithy, it's because in the oral tradition of the teachers of his time, they were training teachers to go out who memorized, you know, a fairly short list of fundamental sermons. So this material was designed to be accessible to regular people who were interested in it, many of whom were not any kind of special people, nobles, Brahmins, what have you. So the Buddha's teaching for regular people impermanence and the deathless, side by side. And that's where, if I could just say this, everything changes, but the nature of things doesn't change. Right? The nature of things is to change, but change doesn't change. You see that little twist? And that goes back to that original, the very first quote I read, you know, which is why I started with it, pointing directly to the heart-mind, in other words, to consciousness itself, or kind of the underlying essence of mentality proceeding, consciousness streaming along. Pointing directly to the heart-mind, see your own nature and become Buddha. See the nature. See the underlying nature of mentality, consciousness, phenomenology, and see also, in some sense, the underlying nature of material reality. And in seeing that, recognize that that's your own nature and become Buddha through that recognition. I mean, that's this incredibly pithy teaching, right? And so it's through seeing the nature of things that they're transient and compounded and that they arise out of and return to something that is transcendental. In that scene, we become Buddha, if only for a moment. You see what we're trying to put together? And so I really invite you, as soon as we intellectualize or conceptualize the unconditioned, where are we? Boom! We're in condition. Right? Just like that. And it's irritating. You've probably noticed that. There you are. You know, it's like unconditionality. And even as you kind of almost turn toward it, like, in the recognition of it, bang, it becomes reified, intellectualized, essentialized, thingified. Whoop, where'd you go, unconditioned? You know? But with a lot of little mini micro practices of that, after a while, there's that intellectualizing, conceptualizing decreases. And more, there's a kind of access to freedom. Because if you think about it, as soon as something is conditioned, it's no longer free. We're stuck with this thought, this sensation, you know, this event. Unconditionality is the base of freedom. And my own view is that people who are very, very far along in their practice, and we can have intimations of this along the way, they have some felt sense of access to or grounding in unconditionality and the freedom that's inherent in unconditionality. It's as if the tip of their root of being reaches into the deathless, from which they live into conditioned existence. But there's always that tendril, that little tip of the root, which, if you're utterly awakened in this model, is ongoing. It's never severed. That is this ongoing access to the deathless from which people draw sustenance, profound sustenance. And my little point on that is this is available to all of us. You know, you can just kind of see that if you come closer and closer to now, there are these little jolts come through you. You start going, whoa. And you start recognizing in a way that what is happening is kind of streaming through a space. The space doesn't change. As soon as we describe it as a space, it becomes a thing. It's conditioned now, but it's like a space through which time flows.
Just a short one. I had an experience tonight during meditation that I've never really had before regarding impermanence, and that was, you've spoken about recognizing impermanence, and we talked about it before. In working with the breath tonight, what I did was at the end of each breath, I celebrated that breath. And I didn't say goodbye to it, I just celebrated it, knowing it was done. And as you talked tonight,
that's great.
I realized that perhaps a threshold for really embracing this was to begin to celebrate the impermanence, not just recognize it.
Well, that's super sweet, and that goes to, I think, something you said. And also, other people pointed out that in a way, death gives life meaning, that kind of thing. Even the micro death of each instant. Yeah, that's really sweet. Thank you. I really encourage you to recognize that this is fundamental teaching and that it's designed to be accessible to us all. And in our own experience, through having clocking more and more seconds per day, ask yourself, how many seconds a day would you say there's a clear sense of being in the now with your mind kind of blown, that stuff's disappearing and also arising? Right? I think that's within reach. How about a second a day? Okay? That's not so bad. You probably already, honestly, are having lots of those seconds. And then ask yourself, what could you do to cultivate more and more of those sorts of seconds? Right? And one way to do it is very much with the breath, to just kind of see it changing over the few seconds of its duration, or to have a sense of your own mind just kind of fizzing away and constantly kind of quivering and changing. Also, try this with the mind states of other people who are aggravating you. You would just love to get your hands into that black box. I would just love to get my hands in and make them think the right way about stuff. Okay, that's easy to notice around politics if you're at all politically minded. It's also easy to notice if you're a parent, right? Or if you have people you work, who you supervise, you know, you manage, you work with, et cetera. You know, we want to kind of get their head straight, get their head right. Well, play around with what it's like to just observe impermanence in the mind stream of other people. And how does that shift your relationship to them in terms of feeling aggravated or reactive about them? Okay? I really look forward to your reflections next week about this. I know this was very hardcore, and if this is new material, it could have been a little mind-boggling. But I'm going to lead you, I'm going to reread one of the key quotes, and then we'll sit for a minute and wrap it up. Okay? The born, the come to be, the produced, the made, the conditioned, the transient, are joined with decay and death. Perishable. That is not fit to take delight in. the escape from that, the peaceful, beyond reasoning, everlasting, the not born, the unproduced, the sorrowless state that is void of stain, the cessation of states linked to suffering, the stilling of the conditioned, that is bliss. Let's sit for a minute. In effect, the Buddha is saying, let things change. Don't depend upon things that change. Grow in your intuition of and take your stand increasingly in that which does not change, the nature of things and the transcendental. And find for yourself what for you doesn't change and feels good to you as your ultimate refuge, your own stainless shore. Look directly into your own nature, and seeing it, be Buddha. See you next week, Buddhas.